Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The president's position on the Defense of Marriage Act has been consistent. He has long opposed it as unnecessary and unfair.
Get used to that voice. That is Jay Carney, the new White House press secretary, former congressional correspondent for Time magazine, among other things. So no more Robert Gibbs, now Jay Carney, as in that case, he talks about President Obama announcing that he will no longer defend the Defense of Marriage Act. What does this mean? How can a president just decide to walk away from a law passed by Congress and signed by a previous president into law, in this case, Bill Clinton? Of course, the gay community is extremely encouraged from a civil rights standpoint, but let's look at what this really means. With me now is Kenji Yoshino. He is a constitutional law professor at NYU and has written widely on this topic. Professor Yoshino, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Let's start at the beginning, because I think people are just starting to get their heads around this. What does the Defense of Marriage Act, as a federal law, actually do?
The Defense of Marriage Act is a 1996 statute that defines marriage for all federal purposes as being between one man and one woman. And it has other provisions, but it's that definitional provision that is the issue of this litigation.
But that's just a definition. That's a statement of somebody's opinion as to what marriage should be, in this case, Congress's opinion or the federal government's opinion. It also does things, doesn't it? Does it stop states from recognizing same-sex marriage marriages that are enacted in other states?
A different part of the Defense of Marriage Act permits states not to recognize marriages that are conducted in other states. So generally, marriages follow the place of celebration rule, so that if a marriage is valid where it's celebrated, then it's valid in any other state. That provision of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, is not what is being challenged. What's being challenged is this definitional provision that says marriage is defined as being between one man and one woman. All that said, you are absolutely right that this has enormous consequences, and the consequences come out when a couple that lives in a state that permits or recognizes same-sex marriages is suing to get federal benefits. In other words, you have couples who, in the eyes of state law, are just as married as a heterosexual couple, but the federal government is not going to recognize them as married. So one of the cases that led to this Obama letter was a case coming out of New York where these two women had been involved with each other for 40 years. They got married in Canada. That was recognized in New York. One of them passed away. Under state law, they were treated completely as married, but under federal law, they were not seen to be married. And because they were not seen to be married, the surviving widow got hit with a $350,000 tax penalty that she would not have had to pay had her spouse been male rather than female.
It was basically an estate tax, right? Here's where gays and conservatives can find common ground, hating
exactly
this dreaded estate tax in this case.
Exactly right.
It also has to do with the nature of one of the suits, as I understand it, that would force the government to declare that gays and lesbians had not been historically discriminated against. Do I have that right?
Basically, one of the things that was really extraordinary about the Eric Holder, that would be the Attorney General's letter, was that he laid out to Congress the reasons, as he's required to do under law, why he was declining to defend DOMA. And in laying out his reasons, he said, I believe that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. Why is it unconstitutional? It's unconstitutional, he says, because sexual orientation classifications get a special form of protection because sexual orientation classifications create groups, i.e. gays and lesbians, who have suffered a history of discrimination, are relatively politically powerless, are marked by an immutable characteristic, and whose attribute doesn't have anything to do with their capacity to do things, i.e. is not related to merit. So on those four grounds, which are grounds that the Supreme Court has set out, he said this group gets special protection from the court. What's interesting about it, though, is that the Supreme Court has not yet said that. So the executive branch is getting out ahead of the United States Supreme Court and making this assessment.
Listeners, we can take your phone calls on President Obama and Attorney General Holder deciding no longer to defend the Defense of Marriage Act in court when people bring suits against that federal law. If you have a question about the legal technicalities here, or if you just have an opinion, you can call us up, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, for NYU constitutional law professor Kenji Yoshino, who has written widely on the topic. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Is there precedent here? Have you ever heard of a president or an attorney general just ceasing to defend a law of the United States before?
Absolutely. So I really appreciate that question because I think that there's a lot of confusion on this issue. I've heard a lot of media outlets saying this is lawless, this is unprecedented. Actually, it's extremely, extremely rare, but it is not unprecedented. And so if we look back over the past three presidents before Obama, each of them has done this with respect to a congressional statute. So just very quickly, if you take George W. Bush, he declined to defend a congressional statute that sought to ban media in subways that advocated for drug reform. And his Solicitor General, Paul Clement, said, "This just violates the First Amendment. I can't defend this. This is unconstitutional." Before him, President Clinton declined to defend a congressional statute that sought to supersede the famous Miranda case, where we get our Miranda warning from, on similar grounds, saying this is a constitutional dimension. If you want to get rid of this, you have to pass a constitutional amendment or get the court to supersede the case. And then, I promise this will be my last example, George H.W. Bush, before him, declined to enforce or rather defend a federal affirmative action program. And if you look to see who the acting Solicitor General was, who not only declined to defend but actually attacked the constitutionality of the congressional legislation, it was John Roberts, who is currently the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wow. So, and I could listen to you give examples all day. They're fascinating because these are the outliers. Alert Malcolm Gladwell. But but what's the standard? Is there a single standard that ties those together? Is there something for you as a constitutional scholar to hang your hat on here if you look back through all those examples and say, okay, presidents and their attorney generals rarely decide that they can no longer defend a law of the land, but it happens when?
Great question again. So the Supreme Court hasn't given us any guidance about when this can happen. So basically, we're just looking at the examples and then trying to piece it together. The most thoughtful treatment of this is actually cited in Attorney General Holder's letter. It is an essay written in the North Carolina Law Review by former Solicitor General Seth Waxman. And Waxman says, of course, as a general matter, it is the responsibility of the president to defend the laws that are enacted by Congress. But there are two exceptions, he says, to this general rule. One is when the president feels that the congressional statute is encroaching on a power that is given to the president by the Constitution itself. In other words, when Congress is intruding upon presidential powers, then the president can actually fight for himself in the court rather than saying, oh, you know, this is a congressional statute, I'm not going to fight it. That doesn't really make sense of the examples that I just gave you. The other exception, though, that Waxman gives that does directly bind together all those examples is when the president believes in good faith that the statute itself is clearly unconstitutional. And so if you look at all of those cases that I just cited to you, in each case, what the executive branch was saying was that we can't defend the statute because we have come to our own conclusion that this is unconstitutional under the Supreme Court's precedents, And so therefore, we would be remiss if we defended something believing that it was actually unconstitutional.
So what changed here? Because until 2 days ago, President Obama was defending this law as constitutional.
So as is usual, I think in an event of this magnitude, I think there are multiple factors that led to this decision. So part of it is that the doctrinal difference between the first challenge, which came out of the First Circuit, and the second challenge, which conveniently came out of the Second Circuit, are different in their kind of posture. So the first case that came out was a Gill case, and that was decided last year where a district court judge struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. And the Obama administration launched an appeal and said, we are going to defend the Defense of Marriage Act. And so, as you say, you know, what changed between then and now? Well, one major difference is that in the First Circuit, there was clear precedent that said that gays do not get the special kind of judicial protection. So essentially, when the Obama administration was appealing, they were asking the district court to reconsider its opinion based on the fact that it believed that it was not applying precedents that were on the books and binding on that district court in the First Circuit. Just to take a step back, the United States is divided into 13 federal circuits, and each circuit creates its own case law and is only required to follow the case law generated within the circuit plus whatever the Supreme Court has said. The Supreme Court has been silent on the issue of what level of scrutiny gays and lesbians get, or more precisely, is not opined on the issue of whether or not they get the special protection called heightened scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
Now when we shift forward to the Second Circuit, there's actually no precedent on the books that says gays get heightened scrutiny or gays don't get heightened scrutiny. And so I think that it forced the Obama administration to say, we have to do some soul searching here. We can't just point to the case law. So that's one explanation. The other explanation is, you know, just a political explanation of, we see which way the wind is blowing here in terms of public opinion polls, and more people are for same-sex marriage. We've gone from a nation that, you know, was where a supermajority was against same-sex marriage just 5 years ago, to polls that are now showing a bare majority being in favor of same-sex marriage, at least some polls showing that. So the nation has shifted very quickly, and I think Obama understands that. And when he talks about his own struggle with these issues and how he's evolving on these issues in the same way that the nation is, I think that's what he's getting at.
And
so both legal and political explanations.
And his critics say politically he did it today because he wants to change the conversation from Wisconsin and the budget and things like that. So we'll leave that to people to judge. My guest is Kenji Yoshino. He is a law professor at NYU. As we talk about President Obama's decision to stop defending the so-called Defense of Marriage Act in federal court, we're going to take some of your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC and some of your comments from our politics webpage. It's a free country. org. Also joining us now, though, is Michael Lavers. He is national news editor for the gay-oriented Edge Media Network. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
And my main question for you is, we've been doing all this legal mumbo-jumbo. What do you see as the real-life implications of this for real-life same-sex couples?
Well, it's certainly a game-changer for the movement, but it's also important to point out that this announcement came out as various states are continuing to debate marriage. As we talk about this, it's important to note that the governor of Hawaii yesterday signed his state civil unions bill into law. Maryland lawmakers this afternoon are actually poised to pass a marriage equality bill. We're talking about it in Rhode Island. Lawmakers in New Hampshire are actually trying to repeal their state's marriage equality law. And, of course, it's an issue in New York. So, well, it's certainly welcome that the administration announced this position yesterday, it's really important to point out that the push for marriage equality continues around the country. So, yes, it certainly affects real-life same-sex couples, but the battle's far from over.
Have you spoken to the plaintiffs in these cases? You're based in New York, and they're based in New York, some of them.
We've certainly followed the case, and Edie is by far one of the best people to talk about the real-life implications of this, and she's one of the plaintiffs in the New York case. So as Kenji was talking about earlier, her case certainly speaks for itself in terms of the impact of DOMA and the real-life implications of the law about which we're speaking. So Edie and other plaintiffs in these cases are quite definitively examples of why this law has adversely impacted thousands of same-sex couples since then President Bill Clinton signed it into law back in 1996.
And again, for those of you just joining us or who haven't read or heard about this in the last day, President Obama deciding to no longer defend the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, the main implication of which is that the law denies federal benefits to couples who are same-sex couples legally married under the laws of a few particular states that allow that. They can get the state benefits. They can't get the federal benefits with very specific financial implications for families. Let's take a phone call. Brian in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Yeah, this is interesting. I'm worried that there seem to be a number of cases now, a growing number of cases where the Obama administration seems to be ignoring the directives of courts. And I'm wondering about the lawlessness, the aspect of it that appears lawless. The first is the case in Louisiana where the federal court struck down the Obama administration shutdown of the Gulf oil production. They ignored that, and they went and did it again. The second one is, of course, the federal case, the judge in Florida who struck down the individual mandate and said that since it wasn't severable, the law wasn't severable, that the whole thing should be considered void, I believe. I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that's what he said.
Right. Of course, you realize that there are various rulings on the individual mandate from various federal courts around the land. Before anything actually changes to compel the president to not implement the law, then I guess a higher court is going to have to rule. But what
I don't
about,
know about that? So I'm not a lawyer, and yeah. I'm wondering.
Well, let's ask
that.
Our law professor, Kenji Yoshino.
And there's another one too.
I
the Civil Rights Commission.
Again, hang on, Brian. Go ahead. What's your third example?
There was a Civil Rights Commission inquiry into enforcement of voting rights violations by New Black Panther Party in Washington, in Philadelphia, and they seem to be. This just seems to be. There's a bad look about it all. It's a bad feeling about the whole thing, and they seem to be disregarding the rules left and right.
Brian, thank you. So he's calling this lawlessness on the part of the Obama administration.
Yeah, let me actually deal with the Obamacare example, because that's the example that I know best, and then tie it back to this example as well. I actually want to make a claim that neither of these actions is lawless. So with respect to Obamacare, you're absolutely right that the Florida District Court struck down the individual mandate provision and then held that it was not severable from the rest of the provision, so then struck down all of Obamacare. But then what he did promptly was to say, I'm going to stay this opinion pending appeal. So what the judge said in a very prudent and, you know, judicious way is to say, look, there's a difference of opinion among district courts in this country. There are now two courts, one in Florida, one in Virginia, that have struck down the individual mandate. And then there are two courts, one in Virginia, and then one in Michigan, that have upheld it. And so basically what the judge is saying is, I'm going to stay enforcement of my order until this wends its way up through the court system to the Supreme Court.
All right. So, and do you tie it back to...
He left it in place.
Do you tie... That's clear. Do you tie it back to this new case with the Defense of Marriage Act in any way?
This is slightly different in the sense that I think that there's a stronger concern here because I don't think any lawyer in the land would say that President Obama was doing anything that was improper or even questionable with respect to continuing to enforce a law that a judge had struck down, but then where the judge had stayed his decision. Here, you know, what he's doing has much less precedent to support it. What happened in Obamacare is completely routine. What's happening here is not unprecedented, as I mentioned earlier, but is less common. And the reason that it's less common is that there's a general presumption that the executive is going to protect and defend the laws enacted by Congress, because after all, you know, Congress enacted that, and either a president signed that or Congress overrode the presidential veto of that, so it's the law of the land.
So, Brian,
the reason that this isn't lawless is that I want to make, I really appreciate the opportunity to clarify this, because there's a really sharp distinction that I would like to make between not defending a law and not enforcing a law. So Obama is actually not defending this law, but he has directed Holder, and Holder has said that he will continue to enforce DOMA. So DOMA is still on the books. It's mm-hmm. still being enforced. All Obama is saying and all Holder is saying is that they will not defend this in court. Congress can now come in and defend it in court, and then we will have this ultimately resolved by the Supreme Court or by legislative repeal.
Brian, we really appreciate your call. Please call us again. And Rachel in Greenpoint, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rachel. This might affect someone you know?
Several people, actually. I just wonder in what other areas of federal law the non-enforcement or non-defense of DOMA will have effect. So, for example, in immigration, which is another area of federal law, if a couple were to be married outside of Canada, could they use, or outside of the U.S. in Canada, let's say, could they use the marital status to apply or petition for immigration if one of the people were not an American citizen? Likewise, when immigrating, if both people are not American, but they're married somewhere else, can they apply as a married couple?
Right. If the DOMA were actually struck down, so we're talking about either the Supreme Court invalidating it or a congressional appeal. So that's, again, not what's happening today. But let's assume now that that has happened. Then all that would mean is that gay and lesbian couples or same-sex couples would have all the rights and entitlements of opposite-sex couples. So you'd actually have to look at the rights that opposite-sex couples have. So you'd have to actually take it right by right. If you look at the right to sponsor somebody for citizenship when you are a citizen and your spouse is an alien, you actually do have that right currently if you are an opposite-sex couple under federal law. So if same-sex couples were granted all of the federal rights of marriage, then they would be able to do exactly that thing, what straight couples can already do, which is to sponsor a non-citizen spouse for citizenship. However, if opposite-sex couples currently don't have that right, which, nobody by virtue of being married gets citizenship in the United States as an alien couple, then gay couples who get married would not have that right either.
Mm-hmm. Michael Lavers from Edge Media, before you go, are you at all concerned about political blowback on the greater cause of legal same-sex marriage? Because you heard the call of Brian from the Bronx, and there's a lot of talk like that out there right now. If the president can be seen as flouting a duly enacted federal law on behalf of a gay constituency.
That's always a concern, but I actually thought about this question before I came on this morning. It's important to note that, folks in Washington are, focused on the budget, they're focused on the economy. Certainly elections, have consequences, as many people say, but I think, if folks are seen, the folks who support DOMA are seen as, pushing back against yesterday's announcement at the expense of the budget, at the expense of fixing the economy and other big-ticket items, there could potentially be a backlash against those folks. So I'm not too concerned about that. It's certainly something to keep in mind moving forward, but there's all of these other quote-unquote big-ticket items that Congress really needs to address. So I'm not fully convinced that there will be a backlash against the administration on this particular issue.
Michael Lavers, news editor for the gay-oriented Edge Media, thank you for chiming in today. And one more quick question for you, Professor Yoshino, and we just have a minute, but a few people have raised this question, and it's a really fascinating one. On the part of the Defense of Marriage Act that the president is not challenging, which allows some states that don't have gay marriage to refuse to recognize the marriages of same-sex couples that are enacted in states that do. On our comments page, R. Lewis writes, people want smaller government. Well, here's smaller government. And there are other laws, too, that we should stop Holder from fighting. Quit spending our tax money on all these legal bills defending these laws. And I guess the point here is that the new Republican Congress, under a Tea Party-inspired policy, is supposed to state a constitutional basis for any new law that it introduces. If someone were introducing the Defense of Marriage Act today, considering that the full faith and credit clause is in the Constitution, you know, that states recognize things like marriage contracts enacted by other states. How could one try to claim that the Constitution authorizes the federal government to say who or who can't recognize a marriage?
Right. Well, the power in question would be the effects clause of Article 4. So the full faith and credit clause has an additional rider provision that says Congress is permitted to determine the effects of the full faith and credit clause. I think it's a stretch, personally, to read the effects clause to cover the kind of enactment that DOMA represents with respect to Section 2. That would be the full faith and credit, that you can deny full faith and credit to marriages from another state. But the language is there, so it's at least an arguable point. What I want to do is to just take a step back, you know, in closing and just say...
And we have 30 seconds.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, conservatives should like, you know, the idea that there's less taxation here. I would underscore that with respect to the provision of DOMA that was actually being where the holder refused to, that holder is refusing to defend, there's a really strong argument that federal government should be out of the business of regulating marriage altogether. So that's also a federal government issue of, like, why is a federal government getting involved in the issue of marriage when marriage has traditionally been defined by the states?
Kenji Yoshino, he is the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at NYU and has written widely on the law of same-sex marriage. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we have the New York State Comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, on an incredible fall in the percentage of the city and state tax revenues that comes from Wall Street, even as Wall Street bonuses go up. We'll give you the details.